Welcome to a special edition of the Movie Film Show, a behind-the-scenes look at movie trailers with Mr. Trailermaker himself, Russell Hondon. And now, here are Mr. Movie and Mr. Film with their insightful interview with Russell Hondon.
Hello, I'm Mr. Movie.
And I'm Mr. Film. And today we welcome trailer editor Russell Hondon to a special edition of the Movie Film Show. Russ has worked in motion picture advertising for over 20 years, beginning with the campaign for Silence of the Lambs and continuing on through all of the Pierce Brosnan James Bond films for MGM, Rob Roy, also for MGM, The Birdcage, I think also for MGM, the most recent X-Files film, and is currently working on the campaign for Smurfs and I'm sure a few others he'll tell us about. He's been recognized several times for his work in trailer editing, including the campaigns for GoldenEye and Rob Roy. And he's also edited several independent features. Russ, welcome to this special edition of the Movie Film Show.
Thanks for joining us, Russ.
Why, thank you, gentlemen. It's very, very good to be here. It's quite a privilege.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking the time on this beautiful day. So, Russ, now you've been involved with trailer editing for a long time. I know you got involved with it pretty much right out of school. So how did you get involved with trailer editing? How did you take that path?
Well, actually, you just hit the nail on the head. My first job out of college through an alumni was a gentleman who owned a trailer company in Los Angeles. And so I moved out here after graduation. I started working in trailers immediately, and interestingly enough, since my discipline in film school was editing, I never really intended to stay in trailers, but it actually worked out in my favor because that was really, at that time, a good foot in the door. And so it was at that company that I had started working on, the film Silence of the Lambs, another smaller independent movie that Orion Pictures put out, Married to It was one of them. And it really launched me in Los Angeles because you look for a way to get in. And I actually said, okay, fine, I'll get into trailers and it'll be a great transition to features because feature people, filmmakers talk with the advertising people all the time. And actually, as I learned, that's really not so much the case at all. Actually, they'd rather not talk to each other.
That's an interesting point. And can you tell us a little bit about, you said you worked for a trailer company. How do trailers go about being made in Hollywood? I mean, it sounds like separate entities are doing this apart from the movie makers themselves and whatnot. Can you tell us about that a bit?
Absolutely, yes. There's a number of companies in Los Angeles, quite a few actually, that are called for all intents and purposes trailer vendors, and their specialty is motion picture advertising. So they create the TV spots, the trailers, the radio spots, the internet ads for their clients who are the studios, that's Warner Brothers, Columbia Pictures, Universal, etc. As Mr. Film had mentioned, I actually was at MGM for a very long time in the in-house trailer department. In fact, I was there off and on for about 12 years. And there are few studios that have in-house trailer departments that do, obviously, their own material. But that's kind of rare these days because of budgetary reasons, and it's actually now more cost-effective to vend out your advertising material to these companies to work on than it is to maintain an in-house department. And so this first company I worked for, company that's long gone called Film Impressions. You know, our clients were Columbia, Orion Pictures, which of course we know has been dissolved, MGM. We won't go into that. and a few other smaller clients. So basically, when you want a trailer done, you normally will go to one of these companies. Currently, I am at an advertising company doing trailers for 20th Century Fox, Sony Pictures Animation, and the like.
So, Russ, you work with the studios, you work with the filmmakers. How do you put together a trailer? What is the principles behind putting together a trailer? Do you create a storyline? Are you talking with the filmmakers? Is it all just the marketing department? How does that whole process, how does that conversation work?
That's a great question. How to start? How do we create a trailer is the main question. And,
right.
Okay, you have a movie. And sometimes we'll usually just actually get the script before we get the movie. We'll read through the script. And, you know, take a few notes, figure out, okay, the primary thing you want to do is who is your audience? Who are you going to market this movie to? And when you decide that, how are you going to make the movie appealing to whatever demographic you have selected? So we'll get the movie in, and many times we'll be working with dailies. We start on a campaign when the filmmakers start shooting the film. So we'll be getting in dailies as they're shooting. We'll be seeing rough assemblies as they come in, select scenes. If the movie is visual effects intensive, we'll be getting visual effects previses, animatics. They're kind of representing what the filmmakers intend for their effects. A couple of years ago, I did the campaign for Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and the first assembly, I'd say that in quotes, the first assembly of the movie for Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs were nothing but storyboards, animatics cut together to the voices of the actors who were doing the roles. And I had to create a teaser trailer using storyboards, which is interesting because normally motion pictures, hence the term motion in the word motion pictures, means it's moving. And storyboards don't really move. They do. They actually were able to cut out some things and do, you know, kind of fake, you know, moves and stuff. But it was, needless to say, a challenge. In other words, we get working with the movie very, very early on in the process. And once we decided, okay, who are we going to sell the movie to? How are we going to market it? Let's start in one direction. So we come up with some scripts, which is basically a copy or a grid, as it has been called. Basically, that's all the either the graphics or the voiceover you're going to hear in between the dialogue bites. And you start structuring a trailer based on a script. And like a movie or a play, trailers also have three acts. There's first act, second act, and third act. Actually, I should say sometimes four because I specialize in what I like to call the rug pull before the logo. So sometimes you'll just start off cold with a scene or something to hook you, and then you cut to the studio logos, and then you start your first act. So that could be like an overture, if you will. But you have a three-act structure that is written out for you, and you start, okay, you know, when I get a feature in, the first thing I do is a breakdown. So I go through the feature and basically practically make a log of every single dialogue line in it, at least those that are trailer worthy. I keep a log of what great scenes, great shots, or soon to be great visual effects are going to be in there. And then using those logs, I get the script from the writers and I start assembling a way to tell the story. And that's where it gets tricky because you start off in one direction to do a piece of advertising, and that may not be the story that the filmmakers at the studio want to sell. Now, that being said, we, of course, send these scripts for approval to our clients before we start cutting. That's the only thing that, you know, we really need to do at that point, because you don't want to start going down a wrong road and I've got the King's Speech, let's go sell it as a musical. Well, okay, you're not going to do that. And right. So you want to make sure that everyone is on the same page before you put a whole lot of time and money into creating a piece of advertising. So once we get the scripts approved, I sit down, I start cutting. And it's basically, you know, to use a cliche, it's like a piece of clay. You start molding it, shaping it, and pulling things out, putting things in. We all edit nonlinear now. It's all computer, so it's pretty much very, very easy to move things around in a structure, in a trailer structure, based on your script. So basically, as you get to the first cut, you'll start introducing a graphic look. You know, we have a great team of graphic artists at the place that I work now, computer artists, who do an amazing job with the look. It's kind of funny because I actually, when I get my script in, I get to read my own copy. So I basically get to listen to my temp voice as I'm cutting the first few cuts of the trailer before we send it to the client. And then we decide who we want to get for a voiceover artist, which is a whole other topic of discussion. And then once that is cut in, we send off the first cut to the client. They know what they're getting, hopefully, with, you know, we don't write down every single piece of dialogue we're going to use in the trailer, in the script that we sent them initially, so we send it off and hope for the best, that we've hit at least what their initial thoughts are. Now, I guarantee you, and there has been only one instance where I actually finished a trailer on a version one. I've only done that once in the 20 years, and that's a monumental achievement. Normally, when revisions come in, and this also is not only when I was working on the vendor side, but also at the studio side, you can easily finish a version 20 or a version 23 of a trailer. I mean, there's been 20 or 23 different looks of this cut gone back and forth between not only the client looking at it, audience testing, just as they test movies. We have rigorous testing for marketing, huge testing for marketing, which is a very important part of the process, because you could think you got the best trailer under the sun and no one else gets it.
Right.
So, is that effective advertising? No, not really. So, eventually you will get something on the screen, as I like to say, but it is a process, and it's that first version that you got to know who you're going to sell the movie to, you got to know how you're going to make it appealing to that audience, and then, you know what, you may, halfway through the process, version 10, version 12, go, okay, it's not testing for this demographic, throw everything out and start again, which happens all the time. Now, I mean, that's also depending on whether or not you've got the luxury of time. Sometimes we have to do a trailer. If we don't come in on a feature immediately, you have to do a trailer and then need something up in a month. And that gets really, really hairy because you've got to basically hit the ball out of the park every time on every script and every cut you send.
Sure. So. Now, it's interesting that you said that, you know, a lot of times these trailers are being made as the movie is actually being shot, which explains, I think, why sometimes we see a lot of cut scenes from movies or sort of alternate scenes. You know, there's a scene that's in the movie, but it's a little bit different in the trailer and that kind of thing.
Yes,
is that
yes.
something that's generally tried to being avoided or it can't be avoided at times? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And you know, I have so many of my friends who I've known through the years go to a movie based on a trailer for one particular scene or one particular joke or one particular moment, and they sit through an hour and 40, 45 minutes of the movie, and then I get a phone call when they get out of the Arclight or AMC going, "You, I'm going to strangle you because that scene I loved was not in the movie." And there's a reason for that. There's a reason. Yes, we work on the movies as the filmmakers are producing them. We have access to dailies. So alternate takes always come into play. What might play well in a trailer as a take or a moment may not play well in the feature. And you've got to realize, too, we are working with a feature assembly, usually the director's cut or a work-in-progress director's cut, so early on. That movie hasn't been through its rigors of testing and in audience research. So what happens is we find a joke or a moment that works great in advertising and not so much in the feature. Okay, boom, that scene's gone. And that's one of the reasons that you see something in the trailer that grabs your attention. You want to go see the movie. Okay, that's great. And wait, it's not there. It's because we work with the material so early on. Now, there's a second reason that a lot of people aren't aware of. So we have the first reason being that, you know, okay, we work with the film so early, we get dailies, we use stuff that may not make it into the final film. We actually go out of our way to shoot stuff for advertising purposes. We work with the filmmakers, and we basically say, okay, here is a line that is played one way in your feature, okay, and or there's a scene that's played this way. It'd be really good if we can kind of change the line and maybe have the actor do it more to camera. And if production is up for it, if they have the time, they will accommodate marketing and shoot pickups of extra stuff that we need so that we can, you know, kind of put that extra oomph into the trailer. We also do what's called special shoots, mainly for teasers. And I probably this moment in time should define what is the difference between a teaser and a trailer. These days, that's actually an old way to refer to them now. They're just called trailer A, trailer B, trailer C. But a teaser trailer is a piece of advertising that comes out literally 8 months to almost a year before a movie just to kind of get the word out there that, oh, this is coming.
And they're usually shorter, right?
Much shorter. And the reason for that is usually sometimes they haven't started shooting the movie yet. So what do? We have to go and shoot something for the teaser. We do that all the time. And maybe that's getting an actor together to say a line. Sometimes they're just starting, you know, we've used camera tests before. They're shooting a camera test, a lighting test, like, hey, let's have this actor do this or whatever. That happens all the time. So that would be the second reason that you end up seeing material that's not in the film.
Now, you've talked a little bit about the process. You've talked about how you get your material, et cetera. You put it all together. You test it. It goes through its own marketing, a very rigorous marketing testing. So you get something out there. Now, you of course, have been recognized a few times for a number of your trailers. I know what some of those trailers are. You've dragged me into the theater numerous times. I have to say a few times wasn't very happy with your work because they're really great trailers for really, really bad, bad films. So for you, when you go and look at a trailer, what's a trailer that grabs you? What are the elements that grab you in a good trailer as someone who has won awards, who's gotten bodies in a theater? And what are some of your favorite trailers out there right now?
As an aside, that's actually a wonderful compliment. Thank you, because when I get people into a see a really, really bad movie, I know I've done my job. So I apologize to anyone.
Unfortunately.
Pissed off for the last 20 years. you got to shell out that money. I know that people, I think, will side with this. There was a period of time, and I think it's still true today, that you go to see a trailer, you go take a look at the poster. There's no point in seeing the movie because you've seen everything, and you know what the movie's about. And I really prefer the trailers that leave you wanting something a little more. You can kind of tease it, but also get enough story to... Trailers are difficult because if you do a complete tease, people aren't going to know what the movie's about, and they're not going to be interested in it. If you go too far the other way, tell the whole story, they're like, okay, well, I've seen it. What I like to do in a trailer is do a combination of both. You kind of set up the story, And then you kind of give little hints about what might happen. Case in point, I just saw this trailer the other day for Source Code, which I really enjoyed the premise of. It's a very well-done trailer. It's obviously a visual effects fest of a movie. And I really liked the way they presented, you know, as far as, okay, here's what's going to happen to this guy on this train, and he has to relive this moment, you know, every 8 minutes. And I'm like, that's great. And you want to know what happens to this guy, because the way they end the trailer is like, okay, you know, it kind of leaves you're almost out of breath after seeing the trailer. That, to me, is what I try to accomplish. Now, then again, it's a double-edged sword. If you don't tell enough story, and the trailer's really cool, it goes to test, and it doesn't test well with audiences because, well, we don't know what the movie's about. It's like, okay, well, you know, what do you want? It's like, okay, we can tell you too much, and then you're going to know what it's about, or we can tell you not enough, it's not going to test well, but it's a really effective piece of advertising. I think one of my favorite genres to work in is the horror genre, and a horror trailer, to do a trailer for a horror movie or suspense film is one of the more difficult tasks, because you have to use certain scare tactics in the piece to get people interested, but you also don't want to give away every single scare in the movie, and that's where you really, really need to, we've developed over the years the 50% black trailer, which is what I call black, meaning black on the screen. And half of the trailer, you swear if you cut it all together, would be just black and nothing, and an occasional scare. And that's a technique we've developed over the years. That's not only scary, but is also effective, and it lets you play at your scares. But no, I think for the most part, my favorite kind of trailer would be a trailer that gives you a little bit of a setup in the beginning and kind of leaves you wanting some more. That's the whole point of advertising, like get people in the theaters. I saw the trailer for Cowboys and Aliens the other day, and I'm, you know, it's interesting because it had me sucked in until I saw the spaceship. but it was really, I'm not going to race out and see the movie by all means, but I really like the style of it because unlike the third act structure, which I previously mentioned, this trailer doesn't have a third act structure. It starts off with, okay, this man, he's got this thing on his wrist, and it's like, okay, you're kind of intrigued, and then it's a Western period, maybe, we're not sure. And then, okay, Harrison Ford shows up midway through the trailer, being Harrison Ford as he likes to do, and then there's a spaceship. And it's all about, okay, they have to get away from the spaceship. We don't know what the spaceship is doing to the town. It blows part of it up, apparently. And it leaves you asking, okay, cool. I think that is probably one of the more effective methods of trailer advertising.
Let's go back real quick. Mr. Film was talking about bad movies and how we've been sucked in to see them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Can you know, as someone who makes trailers, are there any giveaways that we as audiences watching the trailer can know that actually this movie is pretty bad based on maybe how the trailer is constructed or a little wink wink from the trailer maker or whatnot? Can you tell us about that?
Subliminal messaging, something.
Every other frame of go see this movie. Well, you say wink, wink, and it's like, well, we never tip our hand that a movie is bad because every movie we work on is wonderful and it's going to win an Academy Award and it's just like Gone with the Wind. Not so much.
Yeah.
And honestly, I will tell you right now, as you can probably imagine, it is much harder to sell a really bad movie than it is to sell a good movie.
Yeah.
It's a challenge to sell some of these films. And I can't really point to any kind of way to tell if a movie is not great because we so highly manipulate the acting and the imagery now that it's hard to tell, and that's why people get suckered in. That's kind of our secret. And I think, well, as I just mentioned, the horror genre, you know, if you're doing a horror trailer and you have basically you have your title and then you have your button. And the button is basically the moment, the joke, the line, the scare that comes after the title and before the end billing card, the end credits in a trailer. That's known as the button. And so I think in some trailers, if they suck you in and the button at the end is this really lame scare or this like line of like, what are they, who, what? And what did they just say? That is sometimes an indication of, okay, we've run out of material.
Well, or is it...
Well, and a lot of times, too, I think, you know, I see a trailer that basically, you know, the trailer lets the movie speak for itself. There isn't a lot of that manipulation. And I think a lot of times that can be an indication that the movie is actually pretty decent. Like, for example, I remember a very original trailer for The Devil Wears Prada, which was just actually, the first like 2 minutes of the picture. And that's all the whole thing was, which was really interesting. Yeah. And it let the movie speak for itself.
Yeah.
Yes, and Mr. Movie, you bring up an excellent point. I think the more you actually let a movie do what it's supposed to do, granted cut down for advertising, you're pretty much showing, okay, here's the goods that this movie has. Here's what this movie is about. And when you start over-manipulating it, when you start putting in, for let's say a bad action movie, all these really fast cuts and these flashes to white and these blur wipes, and I mean, we're really going in and manipulating the image and the story, then you know, okay, they're trying to hide something. What are they trying to hide something? And honestly, audiences these days, because there is so much advertising, we are bombarded on television and the movies, and obviously the foremost, the internet. Movie audiences now are much, much more savvy. They can see through some of our little tricks. And they know, okay, yeah, this is a good movie, I'm going to go see it. Or they're like, oh my God, they went and just chopped the hell out of this thing. And it's like they were struggling to put all the best scenes together. They put a couple Woods Bang visual effects on it. Boom, there's a trailer. You know, I don't know about this movie. So audiences are definitely beginning to have been able to see through that trick.
You've had some interesting experiences with directors, producers, etc., on particularly the Bond films. Some of the other you've also worked with some A-list directors who we won't name. We'll protect the guilty or the innocent, however we want to talk about it. What's that relationship like? I mean, obviously you're working with the marketing people, say like the James Bond films. That's a big marketing machine, but you also have filmmakers and producers that you need to work with, and they have a vision for how they want to get the picture out as well. What's that relationship like?
Yes, the marketing and filmmaker relationship can be a wonderful experience, or it can be pure hell, because you are dealing with various levels of experience in filmmaking. You are dealing with different directors who have their ideas of how their movies should be marketed, which most filmmakers should not market their own movies. They should not do their own trailers, and there's a reason for that, because I have yet to see a filmmaker trailer that is done competently. They say, oh, the filmmakers cut a trailer, and we sit in a marketing meeting and go, okay, pat them on the head and let's go look at it. And they come up with this 5.5-minute piece of, okay, sort of looks like a trailer, maybe there's a good line here and there. Not a good idea. The exception, of course, to that rule would be the party of Tarantino and Rodriguez, who do their own marketing and do their own trailers, and i.e. Sin City and Planet Terror and Death Proof of the Grindhouse movies. They do their own marketing, and, or at least their own trailers, and there's some wonderful stuff that they come up with. But that, again, that is the exception to the rule. I mean, they've created some of the most memorable trailers, I think, in a very long time. Most filmmakers have some kind of approval on the marketing materials. That would be trailers, that would be TV spots, obviously print ads, that's talking about billboards, bus sides, the poster for the movie. When you're dealing with the Bond movies, they have ultimate control over the marketing, period. That goes without saying. To the point where I've done all the Bond movies in London. They don't even release stuff to this country until the movie's almost done. We're over there working at Pinewood on the advertising for the film. So you run the gamut between working with directors who know exactly what they want, and sometimes it's written into their contract that they have, you get this combination of, ultimate say in marketing or consultation in marketing, and of course they're going to weigh in. Now, what happens is you come up with a trailer. This trailer tests through the roof. It's like, okay, great, we're going to put this out there. The marketing executives show it to the filmmakers. They're like, well, I don't know, you're giving too much story away. We don't know if that's the story we want to tell. And the marketing execs, in order to make the filmmakers happy, because the studio doesn't want to piss off the filmmakers, will go, all right, let's go change the trailer. So you've got this wonderful piece of advertising that has been tested effective, and you have to change it now because the studio wants to make the filmmakers happy. And that is one of the most heart-wrenching, annoying things of the job that I do, because it's like, you have got to be kidding me, people. Now, that doesn't happen with every filmmaker. There are, you're going to make sure that the Bond people are happy. You've got someone coming in doing Beverly Hills Chihuahua. It's like, okay, thank you for your comments. Let's move on. Oh, great spot. Get it out there. So it runs both ways. Filmmakers, and they should be concerned about how, this is their movie. This is their sweat and blood and tears over the last year plus two plus however long it's taken them to make this movie, particularly with the animated films, which take up to 2 years to make. This is their baby, and they want to make sure that every effort is extended to it to make sure it's sold and it's successful, because you know what, it's one of those things where, okay, if a movie is successful, everyone joins in the celebration, and the filmmakers are happy, they make more movies, and the company that did the ad campaign gets more work for trailers. If the movie does poorly, who is the first to be blamed? Marketing. Period. It could be the worst movie in the world, and we tried our hardest. And it makes it costs $80 million to make, and it makes 2.5 at the box office, and that's over 2 weeks. Actually, it wouldn't even last that long at the movie theater. And who gets the blame? Marketing. And it's one thing if you we actually tried this once. I won't mention the campaign, but we tried to actually at one point throw the marketing back into the filmmaker's face saying, okay, you told us to do it this way, and look what happened. That doesn't go over well either. So it's a very tenuous relationship between marketing. You understand their concern. You understand this is their baby, and this is their movie, but you're charged with the responsibility of marketing it, and it's a very tenuous relationship at times.
Now, you've talked about telling stories and the three-act structure, and essentially a trailer, a good trailer, is a little film. I mean, it's a little story.
Exactly.
Have you ever been in a situation where you get the script, you essentialize the story, or you find what's really great about the story, and the horribleness of the rest of the script or the what's coming, you're seeing what's coming through. Do you ever tell a slightly different story? Because I sometimes go watch a trailer. This happened to us, I think, last year with The Extra Man, if our audiences remember. I think that was the first film we gave an F to. Great, great, great trailer, told a great story, and then I saw the film, and it was a nightmare, literally a nightmare. So does that ever happen that you get a script, you essentialize it, you tell the great story that's there underneath all the garbage or that should have been there, and you're basically telling a slightly different story? And how does that work?
That happens all the time. The fact that we have a film that's obviously a very varying levels of story. And so our job is to pick the best one in the movie to sell the film. One movie that comes to mind is a picture we worked on years and years ago called Untamed Heart at MGM. And it was basically marketed as a heartfelt, light romance between the two primary actors, played by Christian Slater and Marissa Tomei. And we really played it up as, you know, they're kind of awkward, they're single, they're looking for someone, and they're going to meet each other and fall in love. And that's how we really pushed this movie, and the trailer came out great. I did a number of TV spots for that film, and people, you know, really wanted to go see it, and they were like, okay, what a great, you know, story. However, the film, and I'm not giving anything away because it's been out for over 15 years, the film itself was a very, very sad, tragic story about this man, this young boy, who was having a transplant, I believe it was a heart transplant, and essentially he was going to die. And, okay, if you took that angle in marketing, I don't think you're going to get many people filling the seats in the theater. So that's one of those things where film has multiple stories, different subplots to it, different tales that are being told. And you need to grab onto that one hook, that one story, and do everything you can to be able to manipulate the imagery and dialogue to sell that one story. And, oh, by the way, he's going to die. Let's not worry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So well, I think a more recent example of that, for example, Mr. Film, we saw The Dilemma, which
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, it turned out to be a little bit more serious and interesting than the trailer just kind of trumped it up as a straight comedy.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and that's very common. I haven't seen the trailer for Dilemma, but people love to laugh. Comedies are one of the most successful genres. They always have been, going back to the early days of filmmaking, as we know. And so if you can find, I shouldn't say this for every drama, but you can usually find certain comedic elements in just about anything. And if you cull all those together and put them together in the right order and come up with something that looks humorous but really isn't, that is, again, really effective marketing, because you go to see a film and it's like, oh, this is kind of lighthearted. It's like, oh, man, this thing is a little more serious than I thought. And that's, again, one of the tricks we use to maximize the manipulation of the sound bites and the order of shots and how things look, to basically create effective advertising.
Right. Now, there are times also, though, that you are pigeonholed. I know that you've worked on pictures that you're working on the trailer. You know it's a mistake. You know that whether or not it's going to test well or not, you know that approach is a mistake. The client is forcing you to do that, or the powers that are forcing you to do that. Surprise, surprise, the film bombs, but it may in some cases may find life on DVD or earlier in video or pay-per-view or Netflix or something. What about that? I mean, what do you just have to grin and bear it in those situations, or what do you do as the trailer marketing people to kind of steer the marketing people in the right direction? Because you guys are the experts.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that kind of, you know, perhaps that situation arises from the filmmakers going, we want to sell the movie this way. This is what our movie's about. We don't want to sell it any other way. And we're thinking, okay, well, our hands are kind of tied. I mean, when I was at MGM in-house, it was a little bit easier because I was closer to that upper level of decision making to say, okay, let's meet with these guys and say, okay, we know we're going down a wrong road here, and you're probably not going to have an effective piece of advertising because of it. And so we could usually get a more face-to-face situation in that case and say, okay, let's really negotiate this.
And well, and I think in recent examples, for instance, in a recent film that's a favorite of mine, is The Golden Compass. You know, it's this big fantasy sort of thing that was marketed as a kid's film. But it really was, I think, more, it had a lot more adult sort of themes. And I think I know more adults who actually really connected with that. And I think that took down New Line, didn't it?
It was one of the last nails in the coffin, as it were, for New Line Cinema. Exactly. Golden Compass. I worked on that briefly in some initial stages of the advertising, even before the film was shot. And we knew we had something really special on our hands. And you're right, they went more after a younger audience, make this a family adventure. And I don't think that movie had the goods to sustain that. And therefore, it just didn't do well because there's also a conflict, because I think that was one of the campaigns, and this happens a lot too. You may start on one advertising direction, and as you're working through the months leading up to the film's release, as the film is being shaped into the art form that it is, you're also shaping your campaign, and what will happen is you start changing your ad direction. You start targeting a different audience. You start selling it a different way. That sometimes is effective, and I think with Golden Compass, that's what happened, because you ended up starting with something that's magical, mysterious, let's go market it like Narnia, and that was,
yeah.
I think, that was the direction we were given, if I remember correctly, on that movie.
Yeah.
And then you start turning into more like a Harry Potter, and then, you know, because Narnia it had its dark moments to it. So you end up with an ad campaign and many trailers, maybe two or three trailers. These days, the average trailer you do for a movie, if you've got the budget, is two. Sometimes you've got a bigger budget, you'll do three or four, like Star Trek,
right,
for instance. You have a number of trailers out there. But what happens is you end up with different marketing messages and different, okay, what are they selling now? And that actually confuses people because they're not sure now what to think of the movie. And essentially,
right,
what you've done is you've told the movie's story through different pieces of advertising, and you don't end up with a cohesive feeling at the end. And I think that's one of the reasons that hurt Golden Compass. Another movie I worked on years ago, a picture for Columbia and Sony called The Water Horse, was another great example of this, where we wanted to sell it as a family adventure. And it was basically a story of this little boy in Scotland who discovers the Loch Ness Monster. And we said, okay, great, family adventure, and it's all about him coming to terms, and his father had been killed in the war, and he didn't know this, and he was waiting for him to come home, and this other man comes into his mother's life. Very charming story, and it's got the Loch Ness Monster in the middle of it all. There are scenes in that movie that are terrifying for children, absolutely terrifying. And I remember when we came out, and my sister-in-law had asked me, oh, you worked on that, we want to go take the girls, my nieces. I'm like, don't. Because I don't think you're going to be able to get through the whole movie without them shrieking their heads off and crying hysterically. And I had to say that because the advertising we created was misleading. And that's the thing. That's how you get people into theaters. And it's interesting on that tangent, you know, people like, you know, you go, you spend your $12 or whatever it is these days, and you sit down, and you're like, I can't believe I got suckered into seeing this thing. It's false advertising. It's like, why aren't people held accountable for this? The interesting thing about motion picture advertising, and this applies to trailers, TV spots, internet ads, we are not considered advertising by any kind of regulatory entity. We're considered promotion. So you can sell a cereal on the market for one thing. It has no sugar in it. It's like you eat it, you become a diabetic, and that they are held accountable for false advertising. Motion picture advertising is not advertising. It's considered promotion. And so we're not basically held accountable for bringing people into theaters and pissing them off because they saw a wonderful trailer that is like, oh, you got to be kidding me. I can't just, I want an hour and 40 minutes of my life back.
Right. Right. Well, it's interesting you talk also about Water Horse and in addition to Golden Compass, because in both those cases, the trailers for both those films kept me out of the theater. I did not see the Golden Compass films in the theater because of the trailer, because I thought it was a kid's movie. So,
well, apparently with both of those movies, it kept more than you out of the theater because
which is unfortunate because the Golden Compass is actually a wonderful film. I've read the books since the picture came out. Yeah.
It's got a great cast in it too. So that's the thing.
It's fantastic. Right? It's very unfortunate. So it does.
I wanted to ask you about music in trailers because I'm a big soundtrack fan. And for example, the Dragonheart theme, the theme from Dragonheart has been used a lot in trailers, at least in the past, not so much recently, like Patch Adams. I know the soundtrack to Searching for Bobby Fischer has been in a lot of trailers. Oh, yeah. Tell us about the music in trailers. When do you use music from another movie? When don't you? When do you use music from the actual movie itself? I mean, I know you talked about how the trailers are constructed as the movie is being made. So sometimes, obviously, the soundtrack isn't available yet. But talk about those decisions and whatnot.
Absolutely. No, music is one of the most important pieces of a trailer because that's what drives it. The music creates an emotion to go with the words and imagery that you've put together to sell the movie. And obviously, you're right. We get working with the material so early, the composer, they haven't even hired yet. So we have no access to the score whatsoever. Now, you mentioned the Braveheart score, which has been used many, many times in advertising.
Dragonheart.
Dragonheart. Yeah. Did I say Braveheart? Actually, yeah. Braveheart, too.
Yeah, sure. Probably, yeah.
another goldie, but a goodie. A lot of the times, if you've got a film that you're marketing that is like one of those movies, you always want to go to that score because you're trying to sell the same kind of film, and people remember that. People remember memorable moments from a score. You said you're a soundtrack guy. You know these scores. And so if you hear that music in a trailer for a different movie, you're subconsciously thinking, oh, okay, this is going to be like Dragonheart. This is going to be like Braveheart. One of the popular cues that we were using way back in the late 90s, I remember, was Aliens. Great for a suspense movie or a horror film. We use that. We use the score from Dracula. We use many, many different scores to sell a movie that was, I've heard this before, it kind of reminds me of this, but it's in this movie that we're advertising. That's one of the reasons why we go to those scores. Now, that being said, over the years, there have been a number of outstanding music libraries that have come up that do orchestrated scoring. I mean, they run the gamut from comedy scores to horror to drama to action-adventure to quirky romantic comedies. We have libraries that own libraries that specialize in different disciplines of music. And it's really, again, being in the trailer business for so long, it's interesting to see where just music alone has gone. Because before, you would have to work with a score from an older film, or you have to get what we used to call a needle drop, which is usually pretty horrendous sounding music. But the way that these libraries have developed now to service the trailer industry, and again, these are only for advertising. You can't buy these. It's music that you license. But these guys, these music libraries, are going out and composing scores using 60-piece orchestras and putting them together and doing different mixes of them. You've got to realize, as we talked about the three-act trailer structure, it's great to use a soundtrack or a cue from a score of a popular movie, let's say Harry Potter. But you realize that that score, that piece of music, is scored to picture to a specific scene or scenes in a movie. And you normally have to really manipulate and cut the music to make it go with your trailer. So what these composers have done who work for music libraries is they create 1 minute and a half, 2 minute, 40 second pieces that have a first act, a second act, and a third act. That's what they do. They create music specifically designed as we need to use it in trailers. Yet it sounds like a major motion picture score. It's one of the most wonderful things that's happened in the last 10 years of motion picture advertising, the development of these music libraries that help us create the same mood. And, you know, I will also say freely, because this, a lot of these libraries will actually make something sound like Braveheart, or they have a couple cues in there that may remind you of Harry Potter. So they're actually keeping that in mind, knowing that, okay, you can go use a score, or we'll come up with a cue or two that sounds like that cue from the movie, but isn't quite, but it's also designed for use in trailers. That being said, it's also very, very expensive to license a score from another movie to use in advertising for another film. It's very expensive. And sometimes composers and music labels will not allow certain scores to be licensed. So you have to go to the library. These libraries are licensable. They're a heck of a lot cheaper than trying to go to BMG or Sony Music to ask, oh, we'd like to license this for this trailer. So that's pretty much how the music is, you know, how we use music in trailers.
All right. Mr. Film was talking earlier about some of the constraints of sort of the creative process. But what about the opposite side of that? What about, do you ever have clients who come to you and just say, you know, here's our movie, do whatever you think is best, and you have that ultimate creative freedom? Can you talk about that side of the experience?
The ability to just do what you want and sell a movie for what you think is best for it is the most incredible feeling in the world, because you can go bananas. Case in point was Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs a few years ago. I did the domestic and the international trailers for that, along with majority of the TV spots. We have an animated movie based on a children's book where basically an invention is made to bring food to this little community who's starving. All they have to eat are sardines. And by the end of the movie, food is raining down out of the sky. Now, how much fun can you have with that? And that's what our clients did. They said, okay, here it is. Go with it. Just come up with a couple ideas. So basically, we ended up taking a very charming film, one of my favorite movies I think I've worked on in a very long time, and by the end of the trailer, it looks like a Tony Scott movie, because it's just action, action, action. And we were given free rein to do that. And that is one of the most wonderful experiences, because that's where advertising becomes fun. Even on you have a smaller independent filmmaker who comes to you with a movie that they put their heart and soul into, and they made it for a dime, and it's like, okay, it's not the best thing in the world. You guys are the experts. Here's the movie. Show us what you think this movie should be and how you think this movie would be sold. That is the most incredible experience, because that's where you really get down and start thinking out of the box. And a lot of advertising these days, you have to do that, because we also work on a lot of mainstream studio material that is so formulaic, and you're going to basically cookie cut your trailer because it was successful before, it'll be successful again, and that's the thinking. So when you're allowed to do a movie that has a lot of going for it, you're not given any constraints by marketing to say, okay, we want to do it this way, or you know, a horror film felt like a musical. It's the most wonderful experience. That's where I really, really do enjoy the marketing and the trailer editing process.
Now, you've been working on trailers for about the last 20 years. Trailers themselves been around, give or take, 80 to 100 years. how have trailers changed? And not just the medium. Obviously, you started. I know you started out with Silence of the Lambs, cutting actual celluloid. Now it's all digital elements. How has it changed? How are the methods changed over the years from, say, the 50s, 60s, 70s, 90s when you started up to today?
Well, basically, trailers have changed a great deal. And a lot of people wonder, well, where does the term trailer come from? And originally, trailers were literally designed to get people out of the theater. They came at the end of a movie, and they came after the credits of the film. And keeping in mind that in those days, 40s, 50s, you had all your credits at the head end of a movie. So basically, a trailer would come after, oh, let's say, your first feature and a double feature and before your second feature. And so back then, they didn't really think, because there weren't that many outlets for advertising at the time, they're like, okay, let's cut together a couple clips from this movie we have coming up and literally assemble some scenes, boom, there's your trailer, and basically we're going to throw it out there in between a double feature or at the end of a movie. And so what's happened is, because advertising has become so critical in opening movies and an advertising campaign, if your movie isn't making X amount of dollars the opening weekends, the theaters, the exhibitors will pull it. They're like, okay, that's it, done, because they have so much product coming in. There's so much product out there now. So what's happened is trailers have evolved from, let's assemble a bunch of clips together. And I'm one of my favorite retro trailers, of course, was, you know, it's like, see it to believe it, and, you know, these huge white letters flying up at you, and you're going, you know, unbelievable, and based on this best-selling novel, it's like an unbelievable story of a man and a woman. It's like, well, we don't do that anymore, because there's no whiz-bang there's no need to do that. So they've evolved from cutting together a bunch of clips to sell your movie to very sophisticated advertising machines, because you have a limited amount of time to get your message across and to sell the movie. And this all started happening in the 70s. People realized if you look at the movies from the early 40s up, you know, it's about the 60s, they're pretty much still cutting together scenes and they're playing stuff out. 70s started experimenting with, oh, let's put in voiceover and maybe put in a couple cards, some graphics, some information in between some scenes. And we've basically seen the evolution of the trailer get faster and faster and faster. And then in the 90s, you started, as I call it, the MTV syndrome. You started with music videos, and trailers took on a very, very sophisticated cutting style in order to sell the message based on the music videos that were being produced. And they got faster. I'm like, and I was, you know, I started in trailers in the very early 90s going, okay, this is cool. We know we're getting faster, but I think things are going to level out here. Well, next thing you know, come the 2000s, the trailers start getting faster, and we start over-manipulating images and going in and cutting and painting characters in the backgrounds that weren't there before, I mean, to sell a joke or to sell a moment in the feature, and they get faster. And basically, the MTV theory aside, I'm pretty much blaming this now on the internet and the attention deficit syndrome that this generation seems to have, because they can't concentrate on anything more than 15 seconds, so you got to grab them. And that's why you end up with a trailer that it's like you blink and you miss it practically. So, and I'm not saying that for every movie. So what we've seen is we've seen the evolution of trailers from something that was, you know, designed to tell people about an upcoming movie, but oh, by the way, go buy popcorn before the second feature starts with a bunch of assembled scenes, to a piece of advertising that's just, we got to sell the story real fast, we got to hook you immediately, because you're either going to be getting up out of the theater, or in this case, because they're run before films, or definitely on the internet. You know, that's the thing, too, because most of the trailers actually get more play on the internet these days. So unless you're hooking someone real fast, they're clicking on to the next QuickTime. They're going to the next Flash movie. They're going to the next trailer on YouTube. And that's where the challenge has been. That's how the trailers have really evolved from an audience that would sit and watch something and actually get part of a story as assembled scenes play, or now it's just, you know, all sorts of smoke and mirrors and, okay, grab your attention or I'm on to the next trailer.
Well, Russ, thanks for spending the time with us today. It was very informative. I hope you enjoyed your time with us, and I know our audience will appreciate your insights into the secret world of film trailers. So thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you very much, Russ, or a.k.a. Mr. Trailer.
Gentlemen, it's been a sincere pleasure. I really, really do appreciate you having me on the show today. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
For us, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And let's solve the biggest question of all. What do you prefer, movie or film?
I prefer trailers. I really, really do. I do. I'm Mr. Trailer. Wonderful. I'm joining the fold.
Yeah, that's right. You'll get a t-shirt next week.
Creates the world of the trailer. He brings the audience into that trailer and makes it grant their innermost secrets. Strictly speaking, it's legal. It's called deception. Trailers feel good when we see them. It's only when we see the full movie realize that something was actually strange.